So early on in the planning process of this conference, when we decided on the topic and we're starting to talk about speakers, one thing I heard from a number of people is, are you going to talk about ASR, aquifer storage and recovery? You have to have ASR. And so we're fortunate enough today that Chris Larson agreed to give us a presentation on one of the first projects in the state that incorporates ASR. Chris Larson holds an MS in Environmental Engineering from the University of Minnesota and a BS in Environmental Engineering from Michigan Tech. Currently works for SEH as a project manager where he oversees water supply and treatment planning and design, and he's been with the company for 21 years. So we appreciate his agreeing to come up and talk today, and please help me welcome Chris to the stand.
Thanks, Ole. As Ole mentioned, my name is Chris Larson. I'm a water treatment project manager with SEH. A minor correction, I've only been with SEH for 6 years, but in the industry for 21 years. I'm here to talk today about an aquifer storage and recovery project that I've been working on for the last almost 10 years with the Joint Powers Water Board. First, I'll give you a little outline on the presentation. First, we'll give a definition of aquifer storage and recovery, talk about what specifically is ASR in this case. Why would somebody use ASR as a storage or, you know, groundwater recharge opportunity? I'll talk about what is the Joint Powers Water Board. I'll get specific into the Joint Powers ASR well number 9. Some of the pilot testing that we were required to do to implement this ASR project, and the current status of our ASR project. So the definition of ASR, in our case, ASR involves storing treated drinking water underground at times when water is available for later withdrawal to meet peak, drought, or emergency demands. Now, in a municipal water system, your demands in the summer due to lawn irrigation and that sort of thing are almost always higher than they are in the winter. So your winter is when you have water available to inject into the aquifer, and then in our case, we're typically recovering in the summertime when demands are higher. That wouldn't always have to be the case. If we ran into an emergency or something, we would certainly have the ability to reverse course and start recovery at some other time. This schematic shows the ASR well, a little bit schematic, but it does a pretty nice job of showing what we're trying to do. In our case, we are injecting into a confined aquifer. That's important for us because we want the water to expand and contract, so when we recharge, the cylinder goes out horizontally, and we withdraw it retracts back in horizontally. It does show a buffer zone. We expect some mixing. There's not as much mixing as you might. I mean, it's good for us that we don't have a ton of mixing, but then there's a boundary there where there's native groundwater. For us, if we're not displacing the native groundwater, the whole ASR sort of purpose, it doesn't exist if we can't displace the native groundwater. So ASR applications. In our application, we're really doing it to peak shave for the water treatment plant, that it's less expensive for us from a capital standpoint if we can treat closer to our average day demands every day rather than treating winter demands in the winter and summer demands in the summer. I mentioned it's seasonal, long-term, or emergency storage. We are storing up to 100 million gallons of water, of treated drinking water, underground. The only thing that limits our recovery of that is the size of the pump, really. It could be to maintain distribution system flow or pressure. If you have an ASR well that's remote or far away from one of your water towers, you could have pressure problems there. Pumping that water would help maintain pressure. And there's all sorts of other potential applications for ASR. that may or may not be applicable to Minnesota. Some of them might be more applicable to some of the coastal California and Florida and that sort of thing. But maintaining wetlands or controlling saltwater intrusion. One of the things I think that this could apply to more directly is the potential for indirect potable reuse of either stormwater or potentially wastewater, where if you are pumping it into the ground in one spot to recover it somewhere else, but it's a way to recharge the aquifer with water that you weren't going to otherwise use for treated drinking water. So I'll mention a little bit about joint powers. The Joint Powers Water Board is a water utility, a joint water utility between three cities. It's Albertville, Hanover, and St. Michael, Minnesota. Now, joint water utilities are fairly uncommon in Minnesota, whereas, say, a sewer district or something like that, where there's multiple cities sending their sewage to one treatment plant, is fairly common. But Joint Powers got a grant in the 1970s to create a joint water system, and they took advantage of that. Joint Powers has seven municipal wells. Four of them are drift or sand and gravel wells, and three of them are Mount Simon aquifer wells. They have 6,500 gallons per minute of firm capacity, and firm capacity just means if their largest well is out of service, they still have 6,500 gallons per minute of capacity. They have a 10 million gallon per day water treatment plant. They collect water from six groundwater wells, send it to their treatment plant where they add chemicals, oxidants to oxidize iron and manganese to remove the iron and manganese from the water, and then add fluoride and chlorine for disinfection and phosphate for corrosion control at their water treatment plant. Their maximum day demand is about 8 million gallons per day. Their average day demand is about 2.5 million gallons per day. And I mentioned earlier that if you can treat closer to your average day demand every day rather than having to build capacity to treat your maximum day demand, you can see that, you know, if you could potentially be between, a 3 million gallon per day and an 8 million gallon per day facility. And from a capital cost standpoint, that's definitely millions of dollars. In 2005 and 2006, the projected maximum day demand for the joint powers system was about 14 million gallons per day in 2020. And you can see that if they have a 10 million gallon per day water treatment plant, they're going to need to add capacity. At that time, they decided to consider an ASR well instead of adding water treatment capacity. In the interest of full disclosure, shortly thereafter, there was a fairly major recession, and things like water conservation have started to take hold, and they really aren't using more water today than they were in 2006. So the likelihood of 14 million gallons per day as a maximum day demand is fairly far out. It still could be 20 years out. So the ASR project, in 2006, the Howard R. Green Company was doing the engineering work, and I was actually with Howard R. Green at the time, but doing the engineering work for joint powers. But between Howard R. Green and CH2M Hill, an ASR demonstration and testing plan was prepared. That really laid the groundwork for the pilot testing and full-scale operation of the ASR system. The plan laid out three pilot test cycles. Test cycle one was to recharge 300,000 gallons and recover 150% of that to waste. The purpose of test cycle one is just to make sure that the mechanical parts and pieces work the way that you expect them to. Test cycle two was to recharge 5 million gallons and recover 150% to waste. The purpose of test cycle two is to see if there's any sort of catastrophic chemical reactions that might be taking place that would preclude this from being a viable project. And then test cycle three was a full-scale test where we'd recharge 60 million gallons and recover 50 million gallons. The intent with this is that we leave 10 million gallons of water in the ground every year to build the buffer. And since then, we have actually done that, which I'll get into. The ASR site, I think the most notable thing in Albertville might be the outlet mall. So if you're driving between Maple Grove and St. Cloud, it's the exit past Rogers. This is a map of the joint powers system. You can see that the wells and the water treatment plant are clustered on the St. Michael-Albertville border, where the ASR site that's labeled new site is actually on the south side of St. Michael near the Hanover border. On this is the Crow River. This is an aerial photograph of the ASR site itself. That red box, the odd-shaped box there, is actually the ASR site. A thing of interest in this site is that about 1,000 feet northwest of this site is a closed landfill where there is groundwater contamination. And there was some concern in this project that that groundwater contamination could migrate as a function of us operating this well. It should be noted then, though, a couple of years later, they drilled an irrigation well that's actually in the same aquifer, and they pumped that too. So I'm not sure why that was allowed. But so joint powers well number 9. It's a fairly typical municipal Mount Simon well. It was drilled in 2006 by Trout Wells. It's 504 feet deep. It has 30-inch casing that extends to 197 feet, and then 24-inch casing that extends to 447, and it's open hole from 447 to 504. I probably don't need to say this to everybody here, but the Mount Simon is a deep, confined aquifer. The Well 9 has a 150-horse submersible motor and a 1,000-gallon-per-minute pump. And it has a 3-inch ASR recharge pipe. Now, for those of you who are familiar with municipal well construction, there's a pitless adapter that's about 8 feet below grade. We had to have a pitless adapter that was specially constructed to allow this 3-inch pipe to go through the pitless adapter. And it's actually a stinger that goes into the aquifer itself, so it's not cascading water down a well column. And the ASR, the recharge pipe, is actually directly connected to the water distribution system, not to Well 9. So the background chemistry for Well 9, and again, anybody that's familiar with municipal water wells, this is fairly typical, but the iron is 1.2 milligrams per liter. The secondary standard for iron is 0.3, and the secondary standards are aesthetic standards and they're not regulated. You don't have to meet aesthetic standards. The manganese is 0.27. The secondary standard is 0.05. So you can see that both iron and manganese are well above their respective standards. The radium, 226, 228, is 9 picocuries per liter. Now, radium is a primary standard. The standard's 5, or the Department of Health allows you to go to 5.4. So we are over a primary standard with radium. And gross alpha, the native water, is 19 picocuries per liter against a standard of 15 or 15.4. So we exceed 2 primary standards. So if this ASR process doesn't work, we cannot, on a long-term basis, send this water into the distribution system. So the well number 9, this is a picture. It's a very traditional, again, the submersible well with this is the joint powers well house number 9. It's a little bit bigger than a typical well house. It does house a standby generator and chemical feed systems. This is the piping inside the well house. Again, fairly standard well house piping, with the exception of this. That's a flushing pipe, and this is the ASR recharge pipe. And this is a close-up of the ASR recharge pipe. I mentioned that this actually doesn't connect to the Well 9 discharge piping. This goes out into the yard and connects directly to the distribution system piping, which then allows us to recharge with distribution water. These are just some pictures of some of the things inside the well house. I mentioned there's a natural gas standby generator and then chlorine and fluoride and phosphate chemical feed systems. This is a plan of the site itself. This is showing that's where well number 9 is, right outside the well house. There are 3 monitoring wells on this site. Test well 3 is a Mount Simon monitoring well. It was actually the test well for the production well, so that's a 500-foot deep monitoring well. Test well 4 is a drift monitoring well. Test well 5 is a FIG or Wanawak monitoring well. Part of what we have to do is continuously measure the water levels in these monitoring wells to verify that our pumping operations aren't being seen, you know, hydraulically by the other aquifers. There's also a test well 6, which is about 600 feet away, and test well 6 is also a Mount Simon 500-foot deep monitoring well. And we continuously record the water levels in all of these wells. So the ASR permitting, and I can say that perhaps the biggest hurdle in all of this is the permitting. The Department of Health prohibits you from basically using a well for anything other than taking water out of the ground. You're not allowed to use a well to inject things back into the ground. So we needed a variance from the Minnesota Department of Health. We did get a variance for the pilot cycles 1 and 2. That variance required additional monitoring. I mentioned the 2 test wells already. It also required that we continuously record the water levels. And then we got a variance for pilot cycle 3, which also required some additional distribution sampling. And I'll get into that a little bit later. So the US EPA also regulates, the US EPA considers this an injection well. So you need an injection well permit from the US EPA. We got a draft permit in 2008 to run pilot cycles 1 and 2. We had a minor modification to that permit issued in 2010 for pilot cycle 3. And then a major modification issued for full-scale testing in 2012. And I can say that the permit that was issued in 2012, it was August or September, and I applied for it in 2011. So it takes, if you think you're going to have, if you come up with this idea, plan for a couple of years of testing and permitting. Or perhaps you should have to pay joint partners royalties for the fact that we had to go through all of this in the first place. I'll talk a little bit about pilot test cycles 1 and 2. Pilot test cycle 1 was conducted in February of 2009. We recharged 361,000 gallons at 310 gallons per minute, stored it 1 day, and recovered 1.3 million gallons to waste. Again, that was just to make sure the mechanical parts and pieces worked the way that we expected them to, and they did. Pilot test cycle 2 was in February of 2009. We recharged a little more than 6 million gallons, stored it for 1 month, and recovered 9.4 million gallons to waste. Again, we wasted the water because we couldn't confirm what the water quality was going to be. The purpose of this was to make sure there weren't any catastrophic reactions that were occurring. You know, and there was an ASR well in Wisconsin where they took water out of Lake Michigan and injected into the aquifer. And when they recovered the water, it exceeded the primary standard for arsenic. But the water that was native groundwater did not exceed. So they took a situation that didn't have an arsenic problem and created one, likely due to the water chemistry and whatever arsenic sulfates or whatever happened to exist in that aquifer matrix. Basically, it wrecked the project. So we didn't encounter any catastrophic reactions in pilot test cycle 2. Pilot test cycle 3, we started recharge in May 26th of 2010 and concluded on October 11th of 2010. We recharged at 310 gallons per minute. And you'll see this number a few times. There's no magic to why that number was picked. It just happens to be a 3-inch pipe flowing full with the valve all the way open. So that's as much as we can recover under the current pressures, or recharge, sorry. We recharged 62.7 million gallons of water and started recovery on January 6th of 2011 and concluded on February 21st of 2011. The recovery rate was between 700 and 1,000 gallons per minute continuously, and we did recover this to the distribution system, so it was used as drinking water. And we recovered 52 million gallons. And I mentioned that each year we're leaving a 10 million gallon buffer in the ground. So we collected samples during pilot test cycle 3. Every day we collected an iron, manganese, and radionuclide sample. Even though they weren't permit required, we felt like these were the critical sort of success parameters. The aesthetic water quality was good. It was a little bit milky the first day. but it cleared up right away, and we haven't seen that since. I think that the Mount Simon is a very white aquifer. I think they just, you know, for some reason we're getting cloudy water for a few hours. The chemical feeds that were required, we're adding water to the ground that has fluoride in it already. And fluoride's not really all that reactive, so when we recovered the water, it basically had almost as much fluoride as we injected, so we didn't need to add fluoride to the water until about 50% recovery. And the fluoride standard at the time or continues to be about a part per million. We did add about 2 parts per million of chlorine as a disinfectant. This graph shows the chloride concentrations in the recovery water. So the yellow line at the top is the recharge chloride concentration. The green line at the bottom is the native chloride concentration. And what we're trying to do here is figure out how much mixing is occurring. Again, chloride is fairly non-reactive, so if you have a fairly significant difference in the recharge and recovery water, or the recharge and the native water, the recovery water then should predict how much mixing is occurring. Again, if you wanted better results, we only took 5 samples over like a month and a half. So, but it does show you that most of the water that we're recovering then is recharge water and not native groundwater. And you start seeing it tailing off towards the end, which is what mixing would predict. So the iron in well number 9 in the recovery, because they have a treatment plant that removes iron, if we can't displace the iron, the whole thing is for naught, really. So this is the background iron concentration, the green line. The yellow line is the secondary standard for iron. And then the blue line is the recovered iron concentrations. And you can see, with the exception of the first sample, the iron results are excellent. On manganese, we see a similar result. Manganese isn't as easily oxidized and probably follows more, you know, with mixing. Again, this is the background concentration, the secondary standard, and our final concentrations. We definitely, even though you see it coming up this above the secondary standard, felt like this was a success. So trihalomethanes is another parameter that we analyze for. And for those of you that aren't familiar, trihalomethanes is a disinfection byproduct, and it is a primary standard. So when you add chlorine to water with organics in it, you end up sometimes with trihalomethanes. Haloacetic acids are another disinfection byproduct. So this is the yellow line is the primary standard. The blue line is the recharge water, and the green line is our recovered water. You can see that trihalomethanes are going up a little bit. We sort of expected that. We're taking water with chlorine in it and adding it to, you know, water that doesn't have a lot of organics but does have a little organics. It's less than 2 parts per million organics, but some nonetheless. So again, this was expected, but since we're below the primary standard, still a success. Arsenic, again, I mentioned that there's been cases where arsenic has been released. This is the arsenic standard, 10 parts per billion. This is the recharge or the background arsenic, and this is the recharge arsenic. You can see that we're, you know, it looks like we're a little bit above, again, not a ton of samples and not far enough above the, you know, not close enough to the primary standard to be of any concern. The radium, again, I mentioned radium's a primary standard. So this shows the radium MCL. This is the background water, and these are the results. So again, the results are good. We had one sort of outlier, and I think that's really what it was, is an outlier. Otherwise, again, good results. The calculated uranium activity at well 9, and I'll get into uranium a little bit more. We did have some problems with sort of uranium. This is the MCL. I'll get into this later, but so uranium activity, the measured activity was this blue line, the background uranium. So we are seeing a little bit higher uranium activity, but again, well below the standard. So adjusted gross alpha. I mentioned that adjusted gross alpha is also a primary standard. This is the red line is the adjusted gross alpha standard. The yellow line is the background adjusted gross alpha, and the blue line is our recovered adjusted gross alpha. And clearly, you know, I've got a problem. This caused me, you know, quite a bit of distress seeing this, because we have a lot of time and money invested in this project. So it forced me to look into what is adjusted gross alpha. The adjusted gross alpha is the total alpha activity minus radon and uranium activity. So alpha activity is just something that some radioactive elements give off. The reason they subtract radon is because it's actually a volatile gas and is burned off in the test. And uranium has its own primary standard, so they're not double counting uranium. The primary standard I mentioned is 15 picocuries per liter. And the alpha emitting elements include radium-224, 226, radon, uranium-224, 238, thorium, lead, polonium, and I suspect I haven't listed them all. But because of the nature of radioactive elements, the gross alpha is changing over time. Because radioactive elements decay, and they decay into other sometimes radioactive elements, sometimes radioactive elements that have more alpha activity, sometimes radioactive elements that might not have any alpha activity. So the reality is, if I collect a sample today and have it analyzed tomorrow, it's going to be one number, but it could be significantly different 6 months from now. And the hold time for a gross alpha sample is 6 months. So it could be, you know, different. And some people at the University of Wisconsin wrote a paper on kind of the inherent flaws of gross alpha testing. So uranium. Uranium is either measured as a mass or activity. The MCL for uranium, and the MCL is listed as a mass, not as an activity. So the MCL is 30 parts per billion, or micrograms per liter. And because there's more than one uranium isotope that emits alpha, if you want to convert it to activity from a mass, there's a conversion unit, but you have to make some assumptions about the relative amounts of activity from the different uranium isotopes. So we had to assume that, not we had to, the EPA assumes that the activity between uranium-234 and 238 are equal when they provide this conversion of 0.67. You'll see that that's not always the case. Luckily, in the pilot test cycle 3, we collected split samples, and we were able to send those split samples to the Wisconsin State Lab of Hygiene for uranium speciation. So rather than taking a mass or activity and trying to convert, we actually measured directly the isotopes of uranium, both mass and activity. So one of the examples, this is just an example, but the sample results from January 15th. The gross alpha, the total alpha activity is 27 picocuries per liter. The uranium mass is 8.7, but to get adjusted gross alpha, you have to subtract it as an activity. So the predicted activity using the conversion is 5.8 picocuries per liter, resulting in a calculated adjusted gross alpha of 21.2 picocuries per liter, which is over the primary standard. So we actually had them measured directly then, instead of converting it. The uranium-234's activity is 12.3 picocuries per liter, with a mass of only 0.2 thousandths of a microgram per liter, or 2 parts per trillion. So very, very, very little mass. The U-238 activity was 2.8 picocuries per liter with a mass of 8.7 parts per billion. So you can see that the assumption that the two activities are the same is nowhere near correct. So the actual uranium activity is 15.1, even though it was only predicted to be less than 6. And the actual adjusted gross alpha is 11 picocuries per liter, which is below the primary standard. So I will concede, though, that the ASR activities that we have is changing the nature of the gross alpha. It's releasing a tiny, tiny bit of uranium-234, and by tiny, I mean a part per trillion, but it's affecting the alpha activity. So this graph then shows the blue line is the predicted alpha activity, or adjusted gross alpha. The green line is the actual adjusted gross measured activity. And then this red line, again, is the primary standard. So after some investigation, we were able to determine that it was a false exceedance. So the annual sampling requirements that we have now for the ASR project, we have to collect background samples from well 9, test well 6, and the distribution samples ahead of injection. We collect monthly injection samples at 95% from test well 6 and well 9. We collect samples at 5%, 30%, 60%, and 100% recovery. And the sampling, the testing is fairly rigorous. And then I mentioned that we collect distribution samples for trihalomethanes and haloacetic acids, which again are primary disinfection byproduct sampling. The total annual cost of our sampling in full production is about probably $10,000 or $12,000 a year. Reporting requirements, we do have to monitor the water levels continuously. We monitor the injection pressures and volumes. We prepare monthly injection reports and submit those to the EPA and the Department of Health. We have an annual summary report. So the current status of the ASR project, we're currently in the fifth year of full-scale ASR operation. On 2012, or say between 2012 and 2015, we recharged between 50 and 90 million gallons and recovered, again, between 40 and 80 million gallons, leaving 10 million gallons each year. Our permit, initially we were only going to try to recharge 60 million gallons and recover 50. The operators decided they'd like to try to recharge 100 million and recover 90 million. You start running into practical limitations. It takes like 6 or 7 months at 310 gallons a minute to inject 100 million gallons. And between that and the recovery and getting the sample results back to prepare the final report, it's hard. We'll probably get 90 million gallons this year, but then it takes, the more you recharge, the longer it takes to recover. So you kind of end up in the cycle. 70 or 80 million might be the practical limitation. So some of the cost-benefit analysis of this ASR system. If you're using it for the purposes we are, you need to compare the capital cost of a new water treatment plant or expansion to the cost of the ASR well. You need additional metering and monitoring equipment with an ASR well. There are annual sampling costs. And you still have the cost of treating water and pumping it. And we're actually pumping this water twice, so there would be a slightly higher cost because we're pumping it once, treating it, injecting it, and pumping it again. And there's definitely more regulatory hurdles with ASR. With that, I'd open it up for anybody that has questions.
Why was the Mount Simon aquifer chosen for this?
You know, I'm not 100% sure. I think you could potentially use the Wanawak. It may be that they felt that the Mount Simon was, you know, more productive. Maybe they could get more water in and out of it. But I don't know that with certainty.
Do you think you'll plug the aquifer up eventually?
You know, that I actually talked to somebody earlier today about that. The reality is we're adding water and recovering it, meaning we're adding it at 310 gallons a minute, and there's a huge cavern that there was like 500 or 700 yards of sand that was blasted and baled, so that the flux rate into the aquifer is fairly low. But then we're actually recovering the water at a higher rate than we're injecting it, and we haven't seen, in 6 years now, we haven't seen any drop-off in our injection rate or increases in the pressure. So at least over 6 years, we haven't seen any decline in capacity. And if we were to experience that, we could have the well developed again, do a little bit more blasting and baling and that sort of thing, but we haven't experienced that to date.
How has the public responded to this, the citizens in that area drinking the water?
You know, we haven't received any negative response whatsoever. It did have to go through like rulemaking, meaning we issued, on more than one occasion, we issued notifications in the newspaper. But we haven't received any negative response. And the water quality is, I mean, we as a public water supply have to promise that the water quality is meets standards. And again, both aesthetic and primary standards were doing well, but no negative feedback. So,
how does groundwater flow in the Mount Simon Aquifer affect what you recover versus what you put into it?
I think because we're doing this on a fairly short cycle, I have a friend that's an engineer that joked that we're going to inject it in St. Michael and Rockford's going to pump it out. I'm not a hydrogeologist, but I suspect it's only flowing a couple feet a year. We're adding enough buffer that we're overcoming the minor amount of movement that we might be getting. So,
in that five-year period, have you had any demand incidents that you needed to use some of that water?
Not necessarily emergencies, but it does allow us operational flexibility in that if we wanted to take a well out of service, you wouldn't maybe normally want to do that in the summer, but if we wanted to, we could. Again, I mentioned that the demands in this whole system haven't really gone up at all. We have plenty of water is really what the story is. But I think going into the future, it does allow us significant flexibility. Even if we took the water plant, maybe not completely out of service, but it would provide a significant amount of capacity if we had to take maybe filter cells down at the water plant.
Question from the water level monitoring that you've done or modeling, have you defined the area within the Mount Simon where that's being influenced by pumping and recovery? The reason I'm asking is you're going to have to limit future pumping in the Mount Simon beyond, it can't get within a certain distance of the recovery setup there?
We do measure, we're adding more water to the Mount Simon in that location than we are recovering. We have a monitoring well that's 600 feet away, and we definitely do see a response both in injection and recovery in that monitoring well that's about 600 feet away. And when you calculate the size of the bubble, too, that we are, it's not as big as you'd think. 100 million gallons of water is a lot of water. And when the porosity is only, I might get this backwards, but only 20% of the space is available for water, it's still, the 100 million gallon bubble is only out about 600 feet. The one thing that I think the initial authors of that report had thought is that maybe they'd put a second ASR well out there, but frankly, that well would have to be off of the Joint Powers. So the Joint Powers owns about 5 acres of land there, and I don't really think, unless you get, you're going to have a well on somebody, either buy new property or something, we don't have room on our property to do it. So, but it's in a wellhead protection area, too, so I think the likelihood of anybody else wanting to drill a Mount Simon well out there is, again, that it's not a municipal well feels unlikely at this time.